Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia on the 6th of March, 2011. I'm Hereward Fenton. Got two interviews coming up today. In about 15 minutes, we've got Leon Ashby, President of the Australian Climate Skeptics, coming on to go through all the details about the nationwide carbon tax protests that are scheduled for the first Saturday in April. And we'll also be going through the issues that separate and the issues that unite people across the political spectrum when it comes to climate change and questions about taxation. I'm really hoping to resolve some of the kind of confusion that's created by the very strong support given to the anti-carbon tax groups by the Australian Liberal Party, which of course is the conservative opposition party in Australia. That has created a polarised situation, and of course many people who are from the traditional left, or you know, the Labor Party left, now perceive that it is purely a sort of a party line thing. And of course many people in the Greens would think that yes, it's just the Conservatives taking up this this battle against the carbon tax, and it's sort of like a right wing viewpoint. But of course so many people that I know are certainly not wouldn't class them as right-wing, wouldn't class them as conservative. There are many people of all walks of life who, A, do not agree with the scientific theories about man-made climate change, and B, do not agree with the solutions that are proposed for this alleged problem. And polls that have been conducted by our major organisations have shown this. Overwhelmingly now, the Australian population is aware that there are, you know, major uncertainties about the science, and they're not happy with the tax. So that is the situation, and we will be covering that in depth with Leon Ashby. After that, I have John Bursell coming on. John is an aircraft engineer, member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and we are going to go through some questions about how do we maintain credibility in the field of research in a subject as difficult and controversial as 9/11, and what are the sort of criteria we need to establish so that we can say to the general public, to random people who might visit our websites, that we are actually taking every step possible to make sure that the information we have is correct. Because there are honestly so many different theories that have come through over the years, and a lot of talk at the moment about various kind of alternative theories to the alternative theories, you know, theories that question the views of groups like Architects and Engineers and Scholars for 9/11 Truth, saying they've got it wrong. And then suggestions are made that this is all part of some deliberate plan, that that we've been led astray by certain people. And, you know, perhaps it's only inevitable that this would happen in a situation where we're basically fighting against a very powerful, organized, global control grid. And the internal divisions that we have within our own groups are sort of a product of our own marginal state within that situation. But it really has to be looked at. And I think this interview with John will hopefully give us a chance to clarify, you know, where we stand, or certainly where I stand and where John stands on some of the really key issues about 9/11. Now, before we get into our interview, I want to go through some of the key headline stories in the news breaking right now. But firstly, I just want to quickly go through some of the developments in Libya. I've been going through a lot of news reports trying to find alternatives to the kind of very lockstep views that have been put forward through all of the media in this country and most of, you know, the international media, that that Gaddafi is insane, delusional, that there is this, you know, massive movement of protest against him, and that it's just a matter of time before the regime collapses. And, you know, we've had reports of sanctions and threatened no-fly zones, and we've got the US military build-up there with a war fleet leaving Crete ready to basically jump in and supposedly, you know, assist the rebel forces in Libya. But there have been a few interviews, one with Gaddafi himself and one with his son, and the views that are being put forward by Gaddafi are completely, of course, in contrast to what we're being told is actually occurring in Libya. And of course, I can't claim to know what is the truth, but the history of the way in which the Western media manipulate information leads me to believe that there has been some degree of deception going on. Now, one of the points to make clear is that Gaddafi and his supporters are saying that there have not been massive protests, that there are not, you know, large squares full of people. And I have not actually cited anything that would confirm or deny that. I've not actually seen any footage of huge street protests of the like that we saw in Egypt. And they're also saying that the attacks that occurred against civilians were largely done by external forces who he's calling Al-Qaeda. And he's saying that these are foreign insurgents who have stirred up trouble in Libya and have actually attacked Libyan forces with heavy weapons. And this has led to an enormous amount of bloodshed. And they're basically saying that this is an external organized threat against Libya. And I just think it's really important to at least give a voice to that alternative point of view. And I just want to play here quickly a clip that was from an interview with Al Jazeera with Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, just yesterday.
Those are my demands. I said this many times before. You know this. I made a lot of statements about this in the last 10 years. All of us, we want democracy, freedom of press, speech, civil society, election, constitution, whatever. I mean, this agenda, there's nobody against it in Libya. But I'm not talking about this. I'm talking about if you have an armored militia, if you have terrorists trying to control oil assets, oil fields, attacking military camps, this is unacceptable. And no country in the world will accept this. The big difference between the two issues, please.
You keep on talking about terrorists being involved in this. What terrorists?
What terrorists?
We only see your own people.
In Libyan TV, it was in the YouTube, the internet, go there and see. Mm. Like what happened in Derna. Have you seen the terrorists executing the people, dozens of people, hanging them on the bridges, burning them? You see them, they are filming themselves. And the broadcast. It's not my video. It's on YouTube. Today it was Libyan TV.
Well, what about the issue of outsiders who have been brought into this country, but brought in by your government to fight your own people? The mercenaries that you've brought in to augment the forces you have.
Give me one evidence.
We've seen
them. Show me one mercenary.
They've been interviewed. They've been interviewed. They're in the newspapers. Their photographs are in the newspapers. You talk about YouTube. Their identity cards are on YouTube.
Identity
this is well done. You've had two senior airline figures resign because they didn't want to fly them into your country.
No,
I mean, you talk about terrorists, but you're using a very strange form of military augmentation to repress what looks to many people like a legitimate civilian demand.
This is a false argument again. If you have black soldiers or black policemen, they are Libyans. They are speaking Libyan dialect. We show the whole people in that way their real identity. We interviewed their families. They are well known. Half of the Libyan population is black.
I just have to leave it there. It's quite an interesting interview, that one. And as you can see there, he's refuting various views which have been put forward in the media, namely in regard to the nature of the conflict there and the foreign insurgents and, of course, the so-called mercenaries, which have been the accusations have been that Libya has brought in mercenaries. And he's saying not mercenaries, just black people who are from Libya. So, look, unfortunately, we're going to have to break at this point. I wanted to get through some other stories, but we'll try and cover some more news in the next break before John Bursell comes on. So please stand by, and we'll bring you now the interview with Leon Ashby of the Climate Skeptics. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free. Welcome back to the show, and today I'm welcoming Leon Ashby, President of the Australian Climate Skeptics, back to the show, and we're going to go through some of the incredible developments in Australian society and politics that are, you know, leading up to this sort of momentous change in our society with the bringing in of a carbon tax. Leon's, of course, been on our show before, and we've been carefully following the developments there with the carbon tax. Leon, welcome back to Truth News.
Yeah, thank you very much, Herwood, and nice to be on the show.
Absolutely. Leon, one of the things I'd just like to emphasise in today's interview is that we, you know, I've been looking at the issues about the questions of climate change and also the questions about the solutions that are proposed to this for many years now. And I never considered it to be a left-right division. I never saw it as being something that there was a left-wing position and a right-wing position. But that seems to be now the main view that is coming through the media, that we're totally polarized on this. We have the Liberal Party backing or opposing the attacks and questioning the science, and we have Labor and the Greens backing the science and backing the tax. What's your take on all that?
Okay, I agree. I think this whole issue, really, it shouldn't be left and right in politics. Unfortunately, politics becomes one of those things where someone wants to try and make it a cut and dried issue to say, hey, the other guys are no good, you better vote for me. And then it sort of gets to, you know, moves on, I suppose. And unfortunately, the whole issue now, most of the media think, for example, that science is settled and all this sort of stuff. Well, it's never been settled. It's never been debated. So, you know, from our point of view, it should be very factual. It should be unemotional. It shouldn't be sort of trying to have these grandiose claims that your grandchildren or whatever will be, you know, so upset with you. You make this sort of decision. That's all rubbish in our view. It should be a very calm, thought-through process of saying, look, there is some evidence or there isn't. If there is any evidence, what's the risks and how much is it going to cost? And you look at it like you would in a business case study, in which a lot of us who've had businesses, we know what it's like to have to sort through what's the truth and what's a bit of hype. And that's how we should be dealing with this issue.
So true. And, you know, I think, Leon, that the questions about the science have actually percolated through to the general public, because we've had these polls that show a massive change in the mood of the populace. There was one poll that was on a News Limited article that showed about 80% of people were totally against the carbon tax. There was another poll that showed 2/3 of people didn't believe in the science.
Yeah, so these polls have been moving right from when we first started, I think. When we hit it off, there was about only 10% of the community would say that they were climate skeptics or skeptical of the science enough to say, hey, let's have a look at it a bit harder. Now, that's moved up to about 40 to 50% of the community saying we don't believe the hype, okay? And then you've got 80% who don't want to have a carbon tax. Now, some of those who don't want a carbon tax, it's mainly for economic reasons, and others it's for because they think the science is, hyped up and it's not really, or the claims of the IPCC and the government are hyped up. So there's a whole bunch of people in there. Now, as far as the community really knowing the facts, I went and spoke to a group just not long ago, the last week, and the whole group, after I'd finished my presentation, there was about 40 people there, and these were highly educated people. These were your CEOs and stuff, and they were sort of pretty well gobsmacked. They hadn't actually looked at all the information that I'd presented to them. I'd say most of them hadn't heard about three quarters of it. So there's a fair bit that hasn't gotten through to what I would call the mainstream, which would be around about 80% of the populace, but they still suspect that it's wrong anyway, a fair number of them.
Yeah, and look, I just want to point out that, from my analysis, what I tend to see going on is that the major parties tend to be somewhat joined at the top. I mean, we know that the Liberals were supporting a climate tax through Malcolm Turnbull. John Howard looked into it. It's quite conceivable that that the Liberals could change their position again on this. But by having a totally polarized position now, it's actually harder to get a unified movement against it. And I actually suspect that this may sound somewhat conspiratorial, but I actually suspect that this is somewhat engineered because we know that there are forces globally that are trying to push this through against the wishes of the population. I mean, we had at one stage, Julia Gillard was saying a majority of Australians support, taking action on climate change, and a majority of Australians support putting a price on carbon. Then these polls came through, and now the rhetoric is saying, well, even, we have to do what's right. So
look, the whole issue is getting clouded, and whichever way they see a poll go, they start to change their position. So, for example, the Liberal Party was saying, this is going to the last election, let's go for direct action. Okay, now direct action meant, things like having sinks, which is basically trees planted, or soil carbon going into the soil. Now, that's all very good, but that was going to cost money. And now they haven't really said what they are really about now, because they're saying they're not going to bring in a carbon tax after, Tony Abbott said a carbon tax would be better than an ETS. So the whole thing keeps getting changed and getting fudged in. But from our perspective, trying to get a movement that's saying, hey, let's get right back to the science, the logic, and let's take it very rationally and think it through. And if there isn't a good case for it, why don't we wipe the whole lot? Now, we're still saying that. Very hard for us to get a lot of media coverage to then, say, for example, do this on a television show, because we think that's where it's really got to happen. TV land has got to have the debate so that most people in society can understand it with some visual things like graphs and some of the details that I've got in my PowerPoint. That's the type of information we would like to get to people, because that people, when they see that, they say to me, I can understand this now. You've actually made it very clear to me, and now I understand why I think it's a whole, it's a lot of rubbish, and we shouldn't be doing anything, whether it's carbon tax or reducing CO2 emissions. It's all pointless. So that's where we want to go to.
Yeah, brilliant. Have you actually had much access to the media, Leon, as the leading, representative in politics for the sceptical viewpoint? Have you actually had many opportunities to get on mainstream interviews?
Look, it's very difficult. Everything on, let's say the ABC with TV, I've only had one question on Q&A that I got into the studio on one show. Then there was a couple of times I've been on radio on different shows where you've got people who are, let's say, prepared to put the sceptical position up there. And a couple of times I've been interviewed by people who didn't know anything about the subject, and they got a bit of a shock once I started giving them some of the facts.
Right.
But it's really, in the big scheme of things, it's only around the edges that I've been able to get my exposure. A couple of other people have been on TV, but they get given a pretty hard time, and that's the Implimer sure. And Bob Carter, they get a few minutes, but each time they've been on, say, ABC TV, they don't get listened to. Everyone comes in very hard and sceptical over the top of them.
Yeah, I did actually hear you on the BBC a couple of weeks ago. I was quite amazed. I turned on the BBC. They were talking about, it was just after the announcement that the carbon tax was going to be introduced, and I think I heard an interview with you on the BBC.
Okay, yeah, well, I've been all over the place, so I don't always know where I get sometimes, but
yeah.
It's nice to think that it is getting around in little dribs and drabs, but certainly we would be only getting, you know, a tenth of the publicity that, say, the other side of the argument's getting, and they get to say some pretty derogatory things about people on our side. They call us names like denialists and all that. We don't even get a chance to say, hey, we're not denying climate change. We're not denying that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. All we're saying is that it's not actually causing the planet to overheat. Therefore, the whole thing's a big hoax and we don't need to worry about it. So they don't really want to get onto that subject. They just want to try and say that anyone who's got a counter point of view must be a weirdo or something like that. That's the only thing they can come up with.
Yeah. And, you know, in the lead up to the announcement about the proposed carbon tax going through next year, at the beginning of, you know, July 2012 is what they're proposing. Mm-hmm. In the last few months of last year, we had a series of big headline stories, and these were in the top newspapers. This was like the Sydney Morning Herald and the Australian. And I was really suspicious about this because I could tell this was actually, they were trying to influence where the country was going. They were saying business demands a price on carbon. You know, mm-hmm. businesses are saying to the government, we need a price on carbon so we can have certainty. And they were saying they're going to put the prices up anyway, even if we don't get a price on carbon, and of course that's what happened, the prices of electricity have skyrocketed already. Can you break that down for us and just explain what is going on there?
Okay, well, there's actually two or three things there. The number one is the political momentum is that they try to find an argument to try and bring in a carbon tax. And so they say things like, we need certainty. Of course, business needs certainty to invest, but if you, number one, you can give them the certainty that the carbon price is going to be zero, or number two, you give them the certainty that there's no need for a carbon tax because the science doesn't, you know, show that there's any necessity for it. You know, so all these things could be there if they're prepared to look at the facts, but they don't want to. They want to say, we want to bring it in anyway. That's already a foregone conclusion, so they make up any argument to say, we've got to bring it in. And then you've got other groups who want to make money out of it, and those groups, for example, which might be your lawyers and your people who are going to be trading in carbon, there might be some renewable energy groups that want to get some investment, they want to get some money out of it, and you want scientists who want to do some more research and they want to get some grants. All of them, sure, they want certainty. They want to keep the gravy train going, so they're putting pressure on the politicians to keep saying those things too. So all in all, you've got different groups trying to manipulate it and go in a certain direction, and it's not logical, and it's not. There's no argument for any of these issues. For example, I'll just give you one point, and that is China is going to increase its emissions in the next 10 years 500 times what Australia is planning to reduce its emissions.
Wow.
So if we go for a 5% reduction in our carbon dioxide emissions, China is going to bring it 500 times more than that in the next 10 years. If it's going to be useless, it's going to be no point. So even when you put that in there, even if you still believed it was going to cause some warming, it's ridiculous. Our effort's going to do nothing. So that in itself should destroy any reason why you'd even bother until China signs up at least.
Yeah, look, that's a pretty powerful argument you proposed there. Can we just take a look at the environmentalist viewpoint? Can we clarify one thing? I mean, do you care about the environment? Do you care about pollution issues? Because, of course, the impression given from the media is that the people who are against the carbon tax just don't care about the environment.
Number one, definitely care about the environment. And, like, whether it's things like renewable energy, we think is a good idea if they can be done economically. But unfortunately, at this point, renewable energy, wind and solar, They don't do anything when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine. In those cases, you need another backup system for things like baseload power, and that just keeps getting ignored in the whole equation. So
sure.
We would say if you could store renewable energy in batteries or some other thing that was economic, it would be worth doing. But at this point, just not worth doing from that point of view. But we believe that any pollution that happens that is genuine pollution, something that actually causes, let's say, some health problems or, you know, poison something in the environment, definitely should be minimised, reduced. Carbon dioxide is not one of those. You won't get any respiratory problems by having carbon dioxide reaching even 10 times what our levels are at the moment. It still wouldn't be a problem. Carbon dioxide is actually beneficial. It's colourless, odourless, you know, gas. It's actually plant food. So, you know, from an environmental point of view, it's actually better to have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to help plants grow faster. So we're very environmental. It's just that the media hasn't painted us that because they want to go on this other hype, and which is the alarmist green position.
Of course,
we want to see good, sound economic things done as well. And that would mean, for example, you don't waste money on things that are pointless. And there's so much that's in many of our planned things like our, say, renewable energy. We're putting a lot of money into that, which is actually our subsidies. We're actually wasting money on things like what's already there because we're not actually getting a benefit setting up our systems of renewable energy at this stage. It's actually costing us five times as much to put up a renewable energy system as what would be with coal or gas or even nuclear power. So there's a whole lot of things we can go into, but you just fire in a question, I'll answer it.
Yeah, sure. And yeah, just getting back to, say, coal-fired power. So, I mean, there's been claims put forward that seem credible to me that the coal power stations actually are quite clean. I mean, they do produce CO2, but they don't produce much toxicity apart from that. Do you have any data on that? Because I've heard various discussion on that, and that, you know, that they've evolved. It's a very advanced technology now. It's a very mature technology.
Yeah, what they've been able to do is there are certain parts of the system which have become very efficient in the coal power stations, and so some of them have, you know, 95% or more, you know, straight conversion of power. Other parts are still 30, 40 and 50% efficient, depending on which part of the process you're talking about. But let's say, for example, you take things like particulates polluting into the atmosphere or nitrous oxide or sulfur dioxide or some of those things that happens normally. And so many of those have actually been able to be reduced down to very minimal amounts. Now, there still is some, I'll grant you that, but the amounts are quite small these days for those power stations which have got the latest technology. So from our point of view, there's not much to worry about. Particulate is an issue. I have a fair bit of info on that isn't in the public debate at this point in time. But yes, particulates, they go into the atmosphere, whether they're smaller in size or larger in size. The larger ones actually help more water droplets form in the atmosphere and actually can increase your rainfall. If you have the smaller ones, it actually can decrease the rainfall. So that's an issue no one's really talked about, but we're aware of that. And if we were, you know, in government or had some people being elected representing us in Parliament, we'd be explaining that to the population, where that could go to make things improve in the future.
Yeah, great. Because obviously issues that are significant in terms of toxicity really are important, and everyone can recognise that. It's just this vexed question of CO2, and of course, with coal-fired power stations, well, you know, the way that they're saying that they're going to make them clean is to use carbon sequestration, which is somehow converting that carbon dioxide into some form of solid matter. Is that what they do? Is they convert it into something solid and bury it?
Yeah, what happens is because you take the carbon dioxide out of the air and you put it into your fibre and your sugars of the plants, and if it goes into, say, trees, 46% is about the percentage of a tree that is carbon. So you're taking carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, it releases oxygen into the atmosphere, and then you have carbon stored in the wood. Now, that timber, if you're growing trees, the tree then can mature at, 30, 50, 100 years old, but then it'll stop becoming a store. It actually gets to a mature size, and you either then harvest the tree or you leave it standing as an old growth forest. If you leave it standing, you've got your carbon is stored there, but you can't use your land or your timber. Now, if you go and use your timber, you then actually start releasing more of that carbon, and produces carbon dioxide via whether you burn the wood or it breaks down with microbes or however it does in the process. And so it takes, you put all your timber into houses or something, there's a bit of a turnaround of about 50 years that all of that would be back into the atmosphere and having to go back and be recycled. So, and if you're getting paid for it, you know, you store your trees and you get paid for it, as soon as you cut down your trees, you have to pay your money back. So,
okay, right. So that's one form of,
people forget about that part of the equation.
But then there's also just the technology for sequestering carbon, which I really don't know that much about, but this is what they call clean coal.
Okay, now that's different again. Now that's putting your carbon dioxide underground. You're basically storing it as a gas in either some aquifer or some underground place, and they basically are talking about pumping it underground and storing it there. The only drama with that is that a lot of carbon dioxide actually escapes the earth and goes into the atmosphere anyway, naturally, and how would you know whether that actually goes down and comes out somewhere else? So it's all a lot of hogwash as far as it being a technology that anyone can say with any great certainty it's going to work. But where I am in Mount Gambier, we have a hole called the Caroline hole where we have carbon dioxide coming out, and it gets caught. Anything that used to be up to, I think, about 90 tonnes of CO2 per week that would then go into things like our beers and soft drinks around Australia.
Right.
So that's what that still does, and that's about 30 tonnes per week, I believe, is about the amount now. But that's just coming out naturally, and it comes out volcanoes, and sometimes when there's earthquakes or other things that happen in the Earth's crust, CO2 escapes.
Now, as I understand it, the businesses that are investing in these technologies are going to earn sort of carbon points. And so if you're a business that's invested in these technologies or using these technologies in connection with your business, then you are going to not have to pay the tax. But of course, to do so will cost you money, and of course the price will go up anyway, simply because it's so expensive for energy businesses and all of the other related technologies to move over to these new technologies. So. But then the government says, well, we're going to compensate you. And this is where it gets really confusing, because the prices have already gone up in anticipation of this anyway. How is the government going to compensate us for that?
Yeah, exactly. Look, it's getting itself caught and tied in knots. What you're saying is exactly right. So there's a number of different systems being proposed. For example, if you're doing emissions trading, you'll be paying to have permits to emit carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and so that's where the carbon trading was. And in that sense, if you're going to go to a carbon tax, you basically, whatever your business is doing in the year, then you have to work out how many emissions you've had, and then you have to pay so much per tonne of carbon, and what that price is. Could be anything from $10 a tonne to, you know, maybe $40 a tonne is being talked about, and you might have emitted, you know, 500 or 1,000 tonnes, and then you have to work out what you're doing as far as paying tax. So you pay tax that year, and then you may get some compensation back because the government's sort of saying, oh, look, you're an old age pensioner, or you're an industry that we don't want to lose your industry, so we're going to give you the money back. Now, this is all, you know, a bit of a funny bit of a game, because people won't know exactly how they're going to be off until the decision's made. Plus, of course, where is the incentive that's supposed to be there to make you move to a new technology? And if the technology isn't efficient, it's going to cost you a lot of money. So I don't see any of this making any difference. And in fact, one energy company has said that the price of carbon that you'd have to pay would be have to be in the order of $220 per tonne to start making a differential for people to move from their current technologies to a new technology, because it would be so expensive with the current technology that it would then be cheaper with a new technology. Now, that's a theory. It hasn't been tested, but that's their working out on how things work today. And at that price, if you're paying $220 per tonne of carbon, you'll be up for tens of thousands of dollars, and an average home or an average business would actually be up for that sort of money.
Right, yeah. So the real result is just people are going to be poorer, and nothing much is going to change in terms of the way the systems work. It's just we're going to have – everything's going to be more expensive, and yep. We'll just wear that.
Right. And, of course, the bottom line is we'll be doing nothing to make any difference to the temperature or floods or droughts. That's all cyclical, and, you know, that'll just happen ongoing. And but it'll still be claimed that, of course, it's all caused by carbon dioxide, by Bob Brown and the Greens, but, of course, it isn't. But that's what'll continue to happen.
Yeah, I mean, look, we could do a whole show discussing the pendulum swinging about, you know, drought is a proof of climate change and flood is proof of climate change. Heat is proof of climate change. Cold snaps are proof of climate change. Well, of course, that they are changes in temperature and changes in weather, but, you know, proof of man-made climate change, well, that just seems to be something that it sounds great for a soundbite and has very little science behind it. I haven't even found anyone really seriously proposing that the floods in Queensland have anything to do with the theory of greenhouse climate change. Have you come across that at all yet?
Yep. Look, we've got people who've been looking at some depth about the claims of floods and all that, because basically it was a grab by the Greens to try and make a bit more hype about getting action on carbon dioxide. And so the bottom line is that floods have always been happening. If you go back historically, Australia's got lots of records of major floods, and, you know, back to the early 1800s, there were some massive ones, and especially much the same as the ones that were in Brisbane now, except they were much higher, and a lot more damage was caused, but there was a smaller population, so less people were probably hurt in the early days, then deaths and that for the amount of flooding. But today, when you've got a lot of buildings, a lot more infrastructure, you're going to have a higher cost when an area like Brisbane gets flooded. But all that aside, the data, when you look at the hard data of flooding, drought, severity of floods, severity of droughts, severity of cyclones, that hasn't changed over the last 150 years with the records that we've got. There's no peak now, not getting more. In fact, it comes in cycles when there's a lot more flooding and periods where there's a lot more rainfall and there's a lot of drier times. Of course, when there's more cyclones around at the times when there's a lot more flooding as well. That just happens to be, and we've always had a maximum of around about 18 cyclones per year and around about a minimum of 5, and that's just been constant since records began.
Absolutely. We're just about out of time. I just quickly want to cover where the climate skeptics are headed. I've noticed your website's changed. Is the Climate Skeptics still an organisation, or has it changed somewhat?
Well, look, we're looking to do a few changes because we want to get some traction. You know, if you're a political party, you don't want to just be ignored. And so we're going to look at some ideas. We've been discussing a name change, but now that the carbon tax has come back in, we'll probably keep the name for a little bit longer. And we'll look to see what we can do to get more people aware of the fact that we're more than just a single issue. We're looking at issues right across the board. We're probably more centrist in our perspective than right wing. We lean a little bit to the right on quite a few issues, but we're not leaning too much to the left, but we're more or less centrist in most positions, looking at responsible spending in government and other policy areas. So we're just looking to broaden out so that we think we should be able to get somebody up in Parliament and in the Senate in perhaps the next election. If we can do that, then we'd like to educate the community a lot more about these issues with the information we've got, so that, you know, politicians aren't just dull and boring and trying to make a big name for themselves without actually helping the community understand issues. We'd like to help them understand issues so then they can be empowered and know which way to vote.
Yeah, that sounds great. We've got a protest coming up on the a nationwide protest on the 2nd of April.
Yeah, that's in Sydney, yep.
And that's a Saturday. So mm-hmm. So we've got 2nd of April in Sydney. Are other capital cities going to be yep. participating?
Yeah, the 23rd of March will be, that's probably when there'll be the most happening, and that'll be Brisbane, Canberra, Perth and Melbourne. They're being organised by other people, not ourselves, but we okay. a lot of our people are involved in that, you know, as individuals. This is more of a grassroots community, bunch of people organising these events. And, you know, the idea is to keep the political parties, whether that be us or the Liberals sort of, or any other group, from dominating it. So it's really anybody comes along and from whatever perspective, we'll be joining in these protests and marches and hearing people speak on the day and hopefully a few stunts. So that's all being prepared. But March 23rd is the big date with the most events happening, and there's one even a bit earlier. I think next weekend will be in Melbourne as well. So just there'll be some websites, but Stop the Gillard Carbon Tax is one website you can look at with those details on it.
Okay, so Stop the Gillard Carbon Tax?
Carbon Tax, yep.
Stop the Gillard Carbon Tax at www.stopthegillardcarbontax or just put yep. that into Google and find
it. Put that into Google yeah. and you should get to probably about four different sites come up. They're all different groups from, different bunches of people who are, organising different events. Some of them have got petitions on them. Some of them are organising it in one state. And if you Google it, you'll find there's quite a few Facebook sites getting people organised there too. Just as the social networking the media opportunity arises, they're using it because it's a good way to get people involved, and you don't have to be linked with a group. You can be anybody in the community who wants to get involved.
That's really, really great. Looking forward to the Sydney one, and of course that's 1 week later. I'll be there. So fingers crossed. I mean, really hope that this does actually generate some numbers.
Yes, and we hope so too, that ordinary people will just see that this is important to go out and make a presence known. If you can get there or get somebody else out there in your family, that's really going to be important for the government and the Greens to realise that people don't want to have a tax that they don't understand, they don't think the science is going to back up, and that really has been shoved on them when Julia Gillard said government she leads is going to bring in a carbon tax. And my question is, who's leading the government if she's not? So anyway, that's where we're at.
Great. Thanks so much for joining us today, Leon.
No worries. Thank you very much, Herod.
Yeah, cheers. Great. Have
See
a good
mate.
One.
Bye.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was Leon Ashby of the Climate Skeptics, and a really, really important contribution there to the debate, I think. So we'll keep you fully covered with all of the stories on that as they develop. This is the Dumbing Down Protest Song by Stephen Phillips.
Over the food chain, but we just don't see the light.
Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Welcome back to the show. I have John Bursell coming on shortly to discuss matters of great importance, but before we do that, I want to get through a couple of stories that I believe are pretty important, and they are in relation to the subject of vaccines. We had an amazing shocker story come through on Friday into the mainstream news, and this was actually reported in the papers. It was also on the ABC, but it didn't seem to make it into the news for the weekend, folks, unfortunately, despite its quite the gravity of the information. Rethink flu policy, says health expert. A leading flu expert has called for a rethink of flu vaccine policy in the light of evidence suggesting people vaccinated against seasonal flu actually had a greater risk of serious illness from the new strain. That's right. People had a greater risk of illness if they were vaccinated. Now, the man calling the alarm is Peter Collignon, Professor of Infectious Diseases and Microbiology at the Australian National University. And he says evidence is mounting to suggest that instead of protecting people from dangerous new flu types, seasonal flu vaccines may actually increase the danger, at least for those not considered at high risk due to other conditions. Evidence from Canada, Hong Kong, and some other countries suggested that people who are infected with normal annual flu experienced a broader immunity over ensuing months than the protection conferred by vaccines. Now, I mean, that's just staggering, isn't it? I mean, when you consider the amount of hype and the amount of pressure that's been put upon people to get this, the flu vaccines, this study is all the more shocking because it actually says that you're more likely to get sick if you've been vaccinated. You're more likely to get seriously ill. You're more likely to get to actually get the flu. Hello? There's something very, very wrong. And this is something that you can tell your mum and dad. This is something that you can tell your school teachers at school. This is something you can tell your GP. They might not know about it. It's very important that this information gets disseminated because I suspect it's going to disappear from the media again after being reported on Friday and you'll not hear about it. But we've got all the links at Truth News Twitter page, Truth News Facebook page, and there's even a report from the World Today on the ABC, which covers it, which was from Friday. So just a couple of other related matters in that subject area. Swine flu communication led to sensationalized reporting. Now, this is actually from the UK. And there's a group of members of parliament in the UK who are actually calling for a new investigation of the way in which the H1N1 swine flu pandemic was managed. I've got an article here from the online Pharma Times. On July 16, 2009, when Chief Medical Officer Sir Liam Donaldson held a press briefing that led to media reports suggesting that in a worst-case scenario, 65,000 people in the UK could die from swine flu. The number of deaths at that time actually stood at around 30. And by the time the pandemic was over, in April 2010, had reached 460 in total, and we're talking about worldwide here. Says a report, and this is in a report published by the House of Commons Science and Technology Committee, so this is from the UK. The reasonable worst-case scenario of 65,000 deaths communicated by the government was useful for emergency responders, but led to sensationalised media reporting, say the MPs, who suggest that it would be better for the government to establish a most probable scenario with the public improvements in how risk and uncertainty are presented to the public. Now, this dovetails with the information about that we've just looked at in regard to the problems with the swine flu vaccine. And I just want to quickly go back to mention the fact that that Professor Collignon, who's called the alarm on this research, blames influential drug companies and frightened politicians for what he says is the overuse of flu vaccines in healthy people. So what we see here is a situation where we had an excessive hyping of the threat, which led to an excessive use of the vaccines, which actually led to an increased risk of illness. And they're all interconnected. Each part of that story is interconnected with the other part. So unfortunately, we have to be conspiratorial here in our view. There appears to be some kind of conspiracy to sell vaccines, and that these vaccines are actually making you sick. And of course, when you're sick, you end up going to the doctor and get more drugs. It's pretty clear. And again, this is something you can share with your most skeptical friends, because it's all very solidly based on scientific research. Okay, I just want to quickly move on to cover another very important story. The Australian government is planning to regulate thousands of common, exotic, and native plants. The Federal Attorney General wants to expand the list of federally prohibited plants. The list currently has five types of plants in it, which can be used as drugs. This is to be expanded to include hundreds, possibly thousands of other species, including all angel's trumpets, many common cacti, many native and exotic wattles, powder puffs, fodder grasses, jimson weed, and many other common ornamental plants. These laws will make criminals out of most nurseries, commercial propagators, gardeners, cactus collectors and farmers, and people working in land care and dune care. Selling just a single one of these plants can cause you to be charged and convicted with a federal drugs conviction and a criminal record. Yes, it's quite shocking. It's really true. I've had a look at it. The information is there on our Twitter links. What to do? You know, it's the noose. The noose is tightening in all different spheres of our society. And as I've endeavoured to point out many times, this is the corporate fascist takeover. And your freedoms are being eroded one by one, and laws are being put in place. And we're really doing very little to halt it or even slow it down. So this is just another part of that, the whole issue of sort of food freedom, which connects back to the questions about Codex Alimentarius, which we were discussing last week on the show. I merely bring this information to you. I don't know what to do. You know, I'm not actually part of any kind of activist network that is actually involved in this subject. I would like to be, but I'm somewhat limited as well in what I can do. But I do think this is extremely important to be looked at as a matter of priority. So we need to look at this new legislation, and please get back to us at Truth News if you've got any new information on this story. And just welcoming to the show John Bursell, aircraft engineer, member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and a major contributor to the 9/11 Truth movement. John, welcome back to the show. It's been a while since we've had you on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Really enjoyed the podcast last week about Generation RX with the director there. You've been doing some great work while I've been away from the fray.
Well, yeah, it's just sort of getting into a new groove for this year. Just sort of trying to tighten it up. Want to have a good focus with each show on getting into some solid content. And if you did listen to the show last week, you'll remember that Kevin Miller made a point about looking at the integrity of information. And I know that's something you're very concerned about, and that's why I thought I'd get you on today to actually talk about this question of how we preserve integrity of information in a field such as 9/11, where we are basically challenging the status quo to start off with. So what we are saying is completely contrary to what all of the official bodies, including the media, including the official government organizations, including the official investigative organizations that were appointed to look into these things, we're going against everything that they've said. So how do we put checks and balances on what we do to make sure that we're not just slipping in furfies every now and then? Because obviously there are so many different theories that have popped up about what happened on 9/11, the whole spectrum of the events that happened on that day. And it would be ridiculous to think that they're all true. I mean, in any field of inquiry, even with the best people, you go down a lot of blind alleys. And so how do we eliminate those blind alleys as quickly as possible? And also, you know, there's this vexed question of how do we differentiate simple mistaken research, human psychology, where people get attached to certain theories and won't let them go. How do we differentiate that from deliberate attempts to undermine what we're doing? Or even can we? Possibly we just can't, and we just have to try and navigate through this using some system of logic and filters on what we do. But there is this continuous question of, you know, is this person trying to undermine the movement? Is this person slipping in deliberate disinformation to lead us down a dark alley? And you know, that's the kind of problem I'm trying to engage with. I'm trying to engage with that all the time, and I know it's been a big focus for you too.
Well, it has. I think integrity of information, as you pointed out, and I really did enjoy that discussion with what was the fellow's name?
Kevin P. Miller, the filmmaker. Yeah.
Okay, quite a well, established filmmaker in the genre of documentary, from what I could read and what I saw, and he was just saying all the things that I've been trying to say, and yourself have been trying to say about this integrity of information, and about, you know, making sure we're only putting forward reasonable arguments that are well-founded in evidence and well-founded, you know, there's precedence for them. There's, you know, there's background information that makes it, you know, seem credible, so that we can take people to the next step on these difficult issues.
Yeah.
You know, it's not such a different issue to 9/11, really, like looking at say, for instance, you know, the way that we drug our children and our people, and, you know, things like vaccines and that are similar sort of issues to 9/11 in a way, because the establishment has this point of view that's been entrenched into the public consciousness about what's meant to be and what, you know, how they're helping us. And the same with 9/11, the whole idea of the 9/11 wars, etc., is that the government's out there helping us, they're saving us from terrorism. So going against this benevolent government that's meant to be helping us and the status quo in the scientific and the intellectual communities is very, very difficult. So it's a sort of a similar topic in a way. And,
yeah.
And as we've moved down this path on 9/11 now, you know, yourself and myself have been researching it 5-6 years now. You know, we've been on a journey and we've seen some really outlandish theories pop up, and we've looked into them. You know, like, I know that there's been a few people that have been raising the issue of mini nukes again. Now, this is something that was tackled, way back, like maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago by Stephen Jones, probably around 2006, 2007. And from memory, he wrote a paper about it. I could probably dig it up. But, you know, this guy was, is a peer-reviewed, published, academic that was considered to be the world's expert on cold fusion. You know, this guy knows. He's got a PhD in nuclear physics. He
Sure.
knows about these issues of nuclear blasts and what sort of damage and radiation and all these other things that we would expect to see and find. He also happens to be an expert of the dust and you know, has been investigating the dust samples from Ground Zero for many, many years. Now, he comes out and actually writes a paper that's peer-reviewed and published saying, look, this is silly. There's no evidence about these mini nukes. Now, when you and me, Harrowood, we see something pop up, we get on the computer and we start looking around. We start trying to look for some information that supports it. And when we look at the mini nukes argument, like the first thing I'd do is I'll be looking, you know, to see what the top scientists that we have in the 9/11 truth movement now are saying about these things. Now, we've got lots of reputable science that we see that fulfill all the credentials. You know, they've got a background, you know, in the scientific area of being published. They've got a background, credentials from university where they've held positions. You know, they're people that have contributed in the 9/11 truth movement in a very positive way. They're people that have attended conferences and become friends with other people and activists and other scientists and worked in groups and moved us forward in the campaign. They've spoken on TV in a very credible way without dropping, you know, a turd in the punch bowl, as we see happen so often with some of these less positive fellows that we've got around the 9/11 truth movement. And we establish, you know, some sort of trust in these people. And they're the people we go to when we're laymen on these issues to see what they think about the credibility of some of these ideas. And sure enough, Stephen E. Jones and, you know, people like Dr. Frank Legg and Kevin Ryan, all these people looked into these things. You know, the people that we really trust, and they say it's garbage, it's baloney, it's silly. And the people that we see promoting it are surrounded by people like Judy Woods, who is the space beam lady.
Yeah.
And Jim Fetzer, who, you know, who has caused problems within the JFK movement and also now in the 9/11 truth movement, well known now to be a complete disruptor within the movement, has been doing it for 4 or 5 years and continues to do it. You know, we see these people, putting forward the information like Kevin Barrett, who doesn't care really if the information's good or not. He just cares if he shows interesting, and he just cares to get the ideas out there. He doesn't really care about quality of information. He never has. He doesn't even say he does. He's just interested in hearing these different points of view. He's what we call a big tenter. Now, just because some guy goes on the Kevin Barrett show or Gordon Duff from, you know, Veterans Today writes about him because he says he's some secret agent or he did this or he did that, I tell you, like, I know from watching Gordon Duff and Veterans Today, which I really don't know what that site's all about, but, you know, they've, you know, made arguments and put out accusations, you know, like the Jews did 9/11 and this, that and the other and it's Mossad and blah, blah. And a lot of the stuff they put out is not fact-based, but a lot of it's good stuff. Like, there's a lot of good stuff comes out of that website, but then we see, you know, 2-4% of it is absolute garbage.
I'll just read
and
just for
is, it's
just,
a real it's a real worry. Like, once I see that out of a website, I don't go there anymore.
I'll just read for our audience, John, just to bring them up to speed from the summary from that broadcast by Kevin Barrett from a couple of weeks ago. Kevin Barrett speaks with community whistleblower intelligence community whistleblower Dmitry Kulazov and Veterans Today editor Gordon Duff. They discuss whether an infamous Mossad agent named Mike Harari bragged of organizing 9/11. Dmitry Kulazov, author of the Third Truth About 9/11, was arrested in Thailand along with Mike Harari. Kulazov says Harari was his friend at the time of 9/11, invited him to a party celebrating the successful operation, and subsequently let it be known in so many words that he, Harari, was an organizer of the 9/11 false flag event. Now, I'll just give you my take on this, right, is more a problem with the whole journalistic integrity of the way this story is presented, because it leaves you as an audience, you are without any means to cross-check any of the claims that are made, because they're made on the basis of, I'm a whistleblower with secret information, trust me. That's it. Everything hinges on that. So if Dmitry Kulazov really did work for the Russian government, if he's honest, and if he really does have this knowledge, then it's all good. But if he didn't, then the whole thing could fall apart. It could be just a story made up. And the world is full of people who love to tell stories, isn't it? I mean, we know that. We know that the world is full of clever psychopaths who like to spin a yarn to make a profit, to confuse people for whatever reason they do. We don't really fully understand it. As to whether they're doing it deliberately to lead us off the track in a COINTEL sense, or whether it's just, you know, abnormal psychology.
And you know what happens, Herewood?
Yeah.
Unless someone decides to make it their aim to debunk and uncover who that person is, like makes it their aim of their whole life, puts their whole heart and soul into trying to figure out who this guy is.
Yes.
What he actually did and where he actually went, and spends, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of hours looking into it to prove this guy's wrong.
Yes.
We're not going to know.
Yeah,
we're
it's really hard, know. Isn't it? Yeah.
So people like Kevin Barrett, you know, who's done some good work for this movement, who really pisses me off when he does things like this.
Yes.
Because it gets all these people in a frenzy about this new information. And he doesn't know it's true. He's got nothing to back it up at all, except for the fact that Gordon Duff supports this guy's story, you know, because he thinks it's interesting. And a few other people support it because they think it's interesting. You know, the whack jobs in the 9/11 Truth Movement, like Fetzer and that, love it because this guy also talks about mini nukes.
Mm.
You know, and it's a real, oh, I got invited to this party where they were talking about 9/11 and how they staged it and this, that and the other. Are we talking about the same American government, you know, who managed to cover up murdering their own president and have probably assassinated hundreds of people to prevent that story getting out? Do you think it's really possible that some guy went to a party where they were talking about these things and is still alive if he was going to talk about it, if he really was who he says he is? You know, it's just ridiculous, like, just to even think that's possible is an idea.
And, you know, in this broadcast, there are three quite extraordinary claims that are made by Mr. Kolesov. One being that he had a personal friendship with a Mossad agent who engineered 9/11. The other being that he knows for a fact that nuclear demolition devices were built into the structure of the World Trade Center. I'm not talking about like a terrorist operation or even a demolition. They were built into the structure. That's what he's claiming. Again, he's not providing any means for us to evaluate that claim. It's just an assertion that's made. And of course, the assertion is that this is something that they do, that they have done, and that he knows that because of his background in Soviet intelligence. Again, which is another extraordinary claim, which lacks any way that we can investigate that. So, and you know, I know a lot of people find this type of thing really fascinating. And from a point of view of keeping you entertained, sure, it's kind of interesting, but I feel like I really need to, you know, and I want to really emphasize this for everyone, is that if you want to get anywhere in your life, you can't be going down these kind of rabbit holes.
Well, there's just not enough time. I mean, it's like with the, I think there's you know, there's people out there that say that Mossad were the people that were used to infiltrate the Al-Qaeda cells within America and actually, you know, aid the hijackers in their quest of getting the planes and blah, blah, blah. That's well possible. Like, I'm not saying it's not possible. That's something that it is in the realm of possibility, okay? So we can talk about these ideas of how things were planned. I know that there was a Mazden, I think it is, in his report recently, he said that there was some evidence that Mossad had, you know, infiltrated these cells. And we've heard Alan Hart talk about the same idea. We've heard Alan Sabrowski talk about it too. You know, that these guys have some credibility.
And sure.
That's right. But, you know, they, at least they're putting out ideas that have a little bit of credibility and they have a history around these issues. So they can speak with their opinion, and they're clear to state that it is their opinion, except for in the case of Sabrowski, that said that it was a fact that Israel carried out 9/11, which really his credibility was shot, in my view, immediately, because he made an assertion without any evidence. Now, so we've had these people make these sorts of claims before, but in this case, you're talking about this guy, you know, he's got three turds in the punch bowl in a row, you know, by the sounds of it, like, and there's no evidence to back it up. So I just don't understand why people buy into this stuff, you know, like, why are they buying into this stuff, Herewood? It's just because it's interesting.
There's this question of why do people buy into it? I sort of do understand it. I've talked to people about it, and I do know that there's a sense that a pressure to find out what really happened, and because there's been such a trickle of information, that people want to find new information. They want to have a sense that we're progressing, and. But another side of it is a little darker than that, and I thought we've really got to address it, which is that there is a tendency to distrust. And of course, you know, we as a group, as a sort of a movement of some kind, are saying that, you know, the establishment science can't be trusted. But then there are those within the fringes of the 9/11 truth movement who are saying that the establishment of the 9/11 truth movement cannot be trusted in the same way. They are basically claiming that the establishment of the 9/11 truth movement, which are people like Stephen Jones and Kevin Ryan and Richard Gage and Niels Harrit, these people are deliberately leading us astray or deliberately covering it up. And again, it's kind of like it's almost like a conspiracy within a conspiracy, if you can imagine.
And that's why they've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of qualified people that support what they say. And they've got the peer review process that anyone can send a letter off, an article off to the Journal of 9/11 Studies and have it peer reviewed and published. You know, we saw an excellent article by James O'Neill, barrister at law from Queensland, an Australian, about the invasion of Afghanistan and how, you know, staying there is untenable and all the reasons that are there. Now, we see these credible people come out and put articles up at peer-reviewed journals that are peer-reviewed by large groups of people within the 9/11 truth movement that have all done positive things to the movement and have moved us forward in a very credible and reasonable way. Now, these are the people that people accuse. Like the other day I put Niels Harrit gave an excellent TV interview in Canada on this tour he's doing at the moment. You know, just really sticking to the simple facts of, you know, of free fall acceleration of 7, nanothermite, how that there's impossible that nanothermite could be made due to the aircraft crashes or the building collapses. And, you know, just pointing out just nutting it out, just very simply, look, you know, what we've been told is wrong. You know, there's another story. We need to find out what that story is. You know, I'm someone that knows how to research these things, and I've come to these conclusions, and I've come to those conclusions with, you know, hundreds of other people that have looked at the evidence as well. Now, this is how we're moving forward. We're not moving forward by somebody making claims without any evidence, you know, going on someone's show that, you know, supports Holocaust denial. And, you know,
yeah,
I'm going insane. Like, I don't want to talk to some of these people anymore, Harrowood, that we know continue to go down these paths. You know, there was no plane at the Pentagon or this happened or that happened, mini nukes or, you know, the Jews did 9/11 or whatever it might be, you know, or the reptiles that are controlling the world, whatever it is. I'm just sick of them. I really am sick of them. I don't want to know about them anymore. I just want to have my little credibility and keep pushing out good information, doing the best I can to get good information out there, and hopefully people will continue to listen. There obviously is a very good and keen and straight group of folks out there working for 9/11 Truth. That's why we continue to move forward. But, you know, these people that want to make claims without evidence, that want to make claims based on, you know, contrived evidence or, you know, manipulated testimony or whatever they want to do, well, that's fine. Just don't annoy me with it. You know, I just don't want to know about it. I want to get to the stuff that we can prove. And that's where we know what that is now. It's quite clear. Go to the Journal of 9/11 Studies, take some time, read some scientific papers, read some papers written by experts like James O'Neill about the law and about international treaties and about how, you know, the history of Afghanistan, you know, how the fact that basically, you know, the Western governments have been invading and mucking with that country forever. And, you know, Russia did it as well. Everyone's been in there and cause them a great amount of trouble. And what's it all about? It's about resource, about geopolitical positioning. It's about drugs. You know, it's about a whole lot of things. We know what that is. We know what that's about. That's how we get the academics and the people within the bureaucracy to understand where we're coming from. When you point out, why are we in Afghanistan? It's obvious why we're there. How did we get there? Well, of course they needed a pretext. That's 9/11. What happened on 9/11? Look at this Building 7. It falls at free fall speed. Everyone understands that that's impossible once you explain it to them. I've never had anyone successfully argue against it, ever. Not ever. All they do is they'll change track to another story or they'll just cast some aspersions on it. Oh, well, that's American building standards or something silly like that. But no one will win that argument. So we've got to concentrate on what it is that we can make the arguments and win. The argument can be made that the events were covered up. Very, very clear the events were covered up. There's lots of evidence there that shows that Zelikow and the 9/11 Commission and all these people covered up lots of evidence. There's lots of evidence there that people lied, that Myers, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Wolfowitz, all these people lied. They told different stories many times. They lied. So we know they covered it up. We know they lied. We know that the buildings were demolished. We've got the evidence there from these hard-working scientists that don't make claims without spending years of research and putting together a paper that is peer-reviewed by many other scientists.
And I just want to emphasise that by in doing so, that they do us the honour, they do us the justice of providing...
They give their lives to it.
Yeah, and they, you know, they provide a reproducible method that anyone can also do. You know, they've done a study of the dust, and they've produced some results. So any scientist can attempt to replicate their results, and that's what we want to happen, you see. And that's why this is so different to someone just making a claim that can never be verified, that can never be reproduced through scientific empirical means. Now, Niels Harrit and Frank Legg and these people, they don't sort of walk around saying that the thermite evidence is proof of the controlled demolition. They actually always start from the basic observations, and that to me is a sign of their integrity and their humility. Because basically what they're saying is the evidence that there was a controlled demolition was there from the visual proven, collapse times. And they wanted to find some additional forensic evidence to back that up. And they did that, and they provided us with some extra forensic evidence in the form of the analysis of the dust and the bilayered red-grey chips, okay? That, of course, is by no means a complete analysis of what happened, but it's just a piece of science that is reproducible that can now be used. And that is the approach that I want to say to everyone out there, that's the approach that has to be followed. And if anyone has a line of investigation that they want to follow who can do this in a scientific way, you can submit an article to the Journal of 9/11 Studies. And if you think that the Journal of 9/11 Studies has knocked back your article for reasons which are not genuine, if they haven't given you a decent peer review, then by all means, blow the whistle and talk about it on my show. But I've never heard anyone claim that. Have you ever heard anyone claim that the Journal of 9/11 Studies has knocked back an article for unfair reasons? It just hasn't come past me.
I mean, Aidan Monahan, put in a paper there about automatic control or autopilot control of the planes that hit the towers by looking at arcs and all these sorts of things. Now that was heavily peer reviewed, and it was cut back to what was provable. I know that this is just one example because I was involved with it in a little way, and providing some information. And anyway, went on to a point where they were eventually satisfied with the paper. It was making claims that were substantiated. And that's what it's about. Now, Aidan might have been 100% happy with that, but his paper was published with what, the peer review thought was reasonable, and that's what it's all about. And there's been other cases too where things have, the nanothermite paper spent, 18 months of self-review before it went off for another, 6 months of review within the journal that it was sent to. Like, these scientists are extremely critical of themselves. They have to be, because they're already out in the limb. They've had to retire, or they've been sacked, or they've basically given their lives to this campaign, and they don't want to be discredited. They don't want to give their life to this campaign and then put out something that's proven wrong. So they're extremely careful that the assertions they make are correct. And that's what it's all about. Now, CIT, the two guys, drummers out of LA, right?
Citizens Investigation Team, yeah.
Investigation Team. Okay, now they made the claim that the plane flew over the Pentagon. Now, they based that on 13 witnesses that all thought it hit the Pentagon, and half of them saw it hit the Pentagon, okay, which doesn't work for a peer-reviewed paper, okay? That sort of thing doesn't work. Sure, it was an interesting idea. There was a hypothesis that maybe the plane came a different direction. It didn't make sense with the debris field that was seen, so consequently, maybe it flew over. Okay, there's no witnesses that saw it flow over. There's lots of witnesses that saw it at the building, blah, blah. We do a scientific paper on this issue. We don't just say, this is our conclusion, here's the evidence, because this is what CIT would do, because the peer review process would tear it to bits until all it was left was, we have two different witness slots of witness testimony. Well, that's strange. We have some sort of, I suppose, psychological effect here that's made people think something happened that it didn't happen, or half of them are right and half of them are wrong. That's what we end up with. We end up some sort of psychological study on why people tell us things that aren't consistent with the evidence. And that's not where CIT want to go with it, is it? So what happened? CIT don't put forward a paper to the journal. They make jokes about the journal. They say it's unscientific. You know, they start casting aspersions at Jones and Legge and Ryan and others because they won't accept their flyover hypothesis. After we see this happen, then we start to see people within the journal speak up and actually say, well, these people are pushing a theory that's not backed by evidence. So, and then sometimes we end up in a situation where Frank Legge ends up, where even though no one submitted a paper to prove their case to the journal, so it, consequently in the scientific world, that means your theory does not exist. It's a joke if you can't produce a paper to back it, right? So
yeah,
that's just a joke. But we see people like Frank Legge dedicate 18 months of his life to working negatively to put forward a paper that will show that we don't know what happened at the Pentagon and it most likely wasn't a flyover. And then we see others going forward with him and Warren Stutt going forward to now properly decode science, like proper with the scientific method and with people that actually have some credentials in maths and science, etc. They recrush the data from the raw data from the flight data recorder and then find it is completely 100% consistent with the official story. And then they have to produce a paper to show that because people like Pilots for Truth won't produce a paper for the journal. They won't communicate with the scientists. They won't correct their incorrect G-force analysis. They won't do anything. They won't do anything that is reasonable and scientific. So we have this process there. And if people are serious about their theories, they need to engage with it. But when they don't engage with it, it means if you're someone that's a thinking, rational person, if someone won't engage with scientists that have great reputations, have great demonstrations of what they can do and how they think, and the papers they've produced have been published in Scientific American and all these other great journals, these are serious guys, they get into a discussion with these people and they work out what's reasonable and what's rational and what works with the evidence, and they come up with good hypotheses, and sometimes they prove something. But what do we see? We see people saying things are impossible without any evidence. We see people saying the plane flew over, this happened, that happened. Mini nukes were used, laser beams were used, all with no evidence and with no peer review process in their assumptions and the things that they've said are true. So what do we make of it? We say it's garbage. We throw it out. We just throw it out. That's what we do with it. It's not complicated. It's a lot simpler than people think. If it's not in the Journal of 9/11 Studies, or it's not backed by hundreds and hundreds of experts and people that have credentials to actually do the work and the peer review process, then we don't need it. It's not in the mix. It's simply not in the mix of ideas.
Of course,
and I don't know why people can't figure that out.
There needs to be some way of monitoring the standards of the Journal of 9/11 Studies itself, because the possibility is any organization can be corrupted. And, so if a claim is made that the Journal of 9/11 Studies is being unfair or something like that, then that there needs to probably be a mechanism to deal with that.
You said we don't know of any cases where
anyone's
wild ideas have actually submitted papers. They haven't. And the other instance is true is that the scientists within the journal, because of people talking and information they're hearing in the public and questions they're being asked at seminars and at presentations, they actually go and look at the issue preemptively and put up information about it to help the activists and researchers figure out what's good or not. The people that make the claims haven't even attempted to put anything forward. So they're not in the mix.
Yeah.
They're simply not even in the mix.
They're not in the mix. And, it would be great to have that help, that assistance. I mean, these people exist. They've put together this group to help anyone who wants to do a scientific paper. They will give you that kind of feedback and help you work out, an empirical way of presenting your information. So, I really recommend anyone who's interested in this seriously, get in touch with these people. And if you've got a theory or an idea, work it through. And maybe you're not a trained scientist, but I don't think that the Journal of 9/11 Studies is going to knock you back just on that. They're going to basically judge you based on your actual work, not on your academic qualifications.
Absolutely
correct?
Not. It's like Kevin Ryan's done these numerous papers now on access to the World Trade Center, demolition access.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just doing research. Anyone can do research and submit it to the Journal of 9/11 Studies. Like, there was no reason why Craig Rank and Adair Marks couldn't actually produce a paper based on this witness testimony and the evidence that they'd uncovered in their view and put it forward. Now, it wouldn't have survived the peer review process because they would have asked for them to show a grid of where all the witnesses were they talked to, and they would have asked them, did they interview all the people that are in the path of the official version? They would have asked them all these other questions. This is what the peer review process done. They would have said, so is there any witnesses to the flyover? And they would have tried to present this witness that they say is a witness, and they would have cut that down bit by bit, stage by stage. This is what the peer review process does. And it would have ended up finding that they didn't have any evidence of the flyover, just so they had these witnesses that thought the plane was in another spot. And this is what happens to the papers that don't cut it. Now, we never saw a paper, but this is what I'm imagining would have happened, and that's why they haven't submitted a paper. It's just like, these other claims, you know, like mini nukes. You know, they put forward a paper to the journal. There's numerous nuclear physicists, you know, scientists involved in the 9/11 Truth campaign, so there would have been many people to review it. Straight away, they would have said, well, there's no radiation in the dust. There's no radiation effects. And then, I mean, these people can come back and say, oh, they've got radiationless bombs now. And the scientists will say, where's the precedent?
Right.
Where's your evidence?
Right.
You know, oh, it's top secret. Oh, well, it's top secret, is it? Well, if it's top secret, we can't peer review it because we don't know anything about it. You know, so you have to get more evidence, you know, and this is how it works, right? So like you said, you get these people saying, you know, I was a secret agent, I was this, I was that, it was a space beam, or, you know, the lizards did it from their spaceship, whatever it is. You know, it's just not in the mix unless it's in reality, right? Now, we know that 9/11 happened and we all got told a story, and that the government lies to us. They lie to us all the time.
Mm.
You know, like, you know, you hunt down really good issues all the time. I mean, you've been following the global warming argument and doing a great job of breaking that down over the years.
Yeah.
You know, you've been following other things with Truth News, you know, the vaccinations and different bits, and slowly working, building the evidence, more and more peer reviews. Now, we've got the chemtrail issue that just keeps coming up. And if you put any chemtrail stuff on my Facebook page, you will be barred and blocked, because you should know my view on that by now. Now, there is some evidence of possibly in America that the geoengineering, it's possible, but I still haven't seen any evidence. I still haven't seen any peer, like, I've seen people take water samples out of their dam on their farm.
Yeah.
And I've seen things like this, but that's not the chain of custody. Do you know what effort Stephen Jones, Kevin Ryan, Frank Legg, you know, Niels Harrit, all these other great scientists, all the people that worked within New York did to get those dust samples in a proper chain
rigorous,
of custody.
It's quite rigorous, isn't it? Yeah.
You know, like, they videotaped the people and their stories. They kept the dates and the times and the transfers and the weights and everything. You know, they did what has to be done with these things. Now, if you want to say that we're being sprayed by, you know, these chemicals, then you have to get some evidence. You have to get a team of scientists together. You have to make your case so strong that people are prepared to give their life up for it. That's what
you
is
have
required.
To, yeah, yeah.
Now, if it doesn't happen, then it doesn't matter whether you're right or not. Like, you can say you're right, but until there's actual real proof, you're not having ministers of government laughing, you know, at you in Parliament. You're not having the EPA and all the other environmental people that actually do this testing for a living. They're not all in on a big conspiracy. Mind you, a lot of people think that they are.
Yeah.
Saying that there's nothing going on, including the Bureau of Meteorology and all these other people. They can't do that. They can't say that nothing's going on if it's not true. What do we see with 9/11? Every time we ask or we try to get information up, they just don't want to talk about it. They avoid it. They don't. No, we don't get government officials coming out making statements about what happened on 9/11. You know, trying to bolster up, you know, the NIST's arguments. They stay right away from it because they know that it's dodgy. You know.
Yeah.
You know, when you see these multiple organisations coming out, government groups and people within the community, all saying that this is a natural phenomenon and that there's nothing going on, and you don't have a group of scientists that are writing peer-reviewed papers about it, it's not an issue yet. You know, I'm not saying it might be real. There could be something to it. But until that happens, and until someone comes and actually takes I've offered this for many people, that I will provide a kerosene sample of Jet A1 fuel that we use every day in the aircraft that are making these supposed chemtrails.
Sure.
Until they actually want to come and take some fuel and test it and do some serious research, they're a joke.
Well, it would at least be a step, wouldn't it? I mean, it's a step in the right direction.
It is. And yeah. It's just, once again, it just goes to show people are wasting their lives and their time on these things. Like, chemtrails is far more popular than 9/11. You know, yeah. Like the idea that the Jews did 9/11 is far more popular with some aspects of the community than, you know, more important research is.
Because it taps into people's beliefs and prejudices. And,
and that's right. Yeah. And you know, and the idea that no plane hit the Pentagon is very popular. It's even popular with people that don't know a lot about 9/11, that aren't 9/11 activists, because that's how it looks. Because we have a plane hitting a building at a massive velocity, which causes, you know, a very unusual accident, you know, and consequently, you know, people like to speculate about it. But when we spend years of research and we look into the evidence and we get to the science of it, we find, no, well, most likely a plane did hit the Pentagon. It's not nice if you thought that was not the case. You know, it's not necessarily, doesn't fit into your way of thinking now that you're a truther and everything's a lie. Well, the facts are that not everything's a lie. About 90% of what's going on is real. You know, they can't lie about everything. You know, that's how they do it. That's how good propaganda works, is that most of it's true and a little bit of it's a lie. And that's how they get things done. They do it very conservatively and very gently, you know. The idea that they changed all the aircraft and they slaughtered all the people in some hangar somewhere and they did all these crazy things on 9/11. They used all this high-tech space weapons and stuff. It's just not... Why would they do that when they can just do it the way that we saw it done? You know, like, it's not that complicated. They flew the planes into the buildings. They brought them down. They had access. We know Kevin Ryan, credible scientist, and others have looked into it. They had the access to the buildings. They had the technology. They had the ability to do these things. And that's what we should be talking about, the things that are reasonable and rational.
I think an argument's been made that seems pretty strong to me, that with the Pentagon, you know, so the people who believe that no plane at the Pentagon are saying that there was this elaborate smoke and mirrors exercise where they knocked down light poles and they, you know, they made a hole in the building to make it look like a plane had hit, and then they flew the plane over. And, you know, wouldn't it have just been easier to just fly a plane into the building? Why would they do that? Why would they go to all these steps to make it look as if a plane hit the building, which is much harder than actually just flying a plane into the building?
That's right. I mean, it sounds a little bit like a debunker, and I mean, you've accused me of this before, you know. But the thing is that that's exactly right, because, you know, we know that they armor-plated that section of the building, and we know that it wasn't very heavily populated, so it suited their aims. They didn't want to kill too many of their own, obviously, you know. They want to do as little damage as possible. That's why the planes hit before, you know, 9 in the morning. You know, they didn't want to cause too much trouble. They wanted to have a big enough impact on the people and the psyche of the American people to, you know, go to war, but they didn't want to, you know, kill half the people in the Pentagon because it's not conducive to their purposes, you know.
Yeah, so, it was limited,
And obviously they want to get rid of the people on the plane because, you know, they're people that have been involved with what's going on and they might have information and this, that and the other. So to make sure that the people die in the plane crash makes good sense.
Absolutely.
You know, to make sure, you know, to make sure that a lot of the people on the plane could have been people that you don't want to survive anyway because they might know something about the story. There's a whole lot of reasons, but at the end of the day, to do it as we saw it is the most reasonable explanation of what happened. You know, we don't know that's true, but we're not going to prove anything else. You know, we've got to stick to the things that we're winning on. We're winning on WTC-7. You know, we're winning on the cover-up. We're winning on why we're in Afghanistan. We're winning on all these things that are very easy to demonstrate and very clear to rational people of why we need a new investigation. You know, it's not rocket science.
Absolutely. John, we've run out of time. Just like to... I'm sure we're going to get some hate mail as a result of this broadcast. And I hope, I hope that those out there who do feel offended by what we say, I hope that you can just like at least think about it a little bit before you send the hate mail. You know, just have a bit of a think about it. Let it percolate through your head. You know, because I think you'll find there's some sense in what we're saying here.
Yeah, and I'm just, you know, like, look, at the process that we have in place for these things, the peer review process. People make, you know, Kevin Barrett gets some loon on his show and says this, that and the other. There's no evidence to back it up, and you can't establish who this person is. You simply, you know, you can't bona fide what he's saying. Then let it go. You know, like, sure, yeah, it's an interesting idea, but let it go. What's the point of pursuing it?
Yeah.
You know, there's so many great things to be, you know, truth to be spreading out there at the moment. There's so many bad things going on in the world. Why are you wasting your time on this esoteric garbage, you know, like, really?
Great.
Anyway.
On that note, look, thanks so much for coming on today, John.
No worries, Harry. Yeah. It's always a pleasure.
It's been great talking to you. Cheers.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed today's show. A bit of variety there and a bit of controversy. And please send us your criticisms, your whatever it is you have to say. We'll take it all on the chin, as it were. Have a great week and see you next time around. This is Truth News Radio Australia signing off.